This is Directional, a podcast about video games and the creative rebellion.
Let's just do this thing, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
So I heard someone's email. Whose email was that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wonder. I have to turn it off. I'm not sure.
Andre, so naughty. Already. Already causing problems. Troublemaker.
Andre is just trying to prove to us that he's modern.
Yeah, it's never too late or early for spam. It's coming into vogue again because the war generation, the boomers, are all addicted to spam because that's what they ate in World War II. And when they came home, they ate it again, and then it went out of style, and it's back.
We also haven't died in ditches for a while, so maybe we should start digging some and see, you know, like return to the good old days.
Dude, we're trying hard.
Working on it, yeah. But here we are. We might use this. Who knows? I mean, Paul will just might just magically cut that in because that was good. I like that. But here we are, Chantal, with another episode of Directional.
Yeah, God, who lets us keep making these?
We don't know yet, do we? It's going to be an ongoing test on sort of the global population. Should they choose to listen, I advise that they tune in because
you know, wouldn't you?
I know, because it's all about the money. which is why, on this episode right here, we've decided to have the most capitalist of guests. I mean, just a vile creature of just pure profiteering, i.e., a poet.
Yes. It's what they do. They're purely in it for the money you can get when you're dealing with a poet.
Andre Codrescu, it is an absolute joy to have you on Directional. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you very much. Poetry is the new currency. It is the new Bitcoin. You know, it's so virtual and so untouched that it is going to rise in price and value.
I am down for the poetry barter system. Like, two bananas for a poem, friend.
Yeah.
I'm here for it. I would be rich as hell. Like, it's fine. Got poems coming out of my ears.
It is interesting to me, though, because, you know, Chantal, I don't know if you knew Andre, because I haven't spoken to Andre, dear listener, for many years until we decided to exchange emails a few weeks ago. And last time I talked to Andre was about 12 years ago, just as my daughter was, shortly after my daughter was born. So it's been a while. But of course, as all people, Andre hasn't changed at all. And he was thankfully always an incredible inspiration and a wonderful human being. So having him on the show is incredible. But I don't know if you knew that, Andre, but Chantal is a game designer, narrative designer, an AI wizard, a poet, an anthropologist. And I, you know, before we got on the show and I was sort of warming up with Andre and waiting for Chantal to tune in from Adelaide, I called you an AI poet to Andre. And I thought that sort of rang true to me.
I mean, I spend quite a lot of time with my AI writing poems or asking them to write me poems and then do it better. What do you think about that, Andre?
How does it, how do you do that? Do you give it a prompt and say, write a poem about something, or write a poem like T.S. Eliot? Or,
no, not at all. I find that quite filthy, actually. I don't want to be like anyone else. I don't want my little creatures to be like anybody else. I think of it more like a collaboration with machine and chaos. I think the machine is more of an interface with the fabric of the universe. If you really think about how computers work, how we interact with computers, it's really through essentially numbers and waves. We've got the binary going on. We've got like charges of electricity. And what we're really doing when we mess with a computer is we're kind of like interacting with this mathematical chaos of the universe. And so I find poetry kind of trying to, an attempt to wrangle that chaos of the universe. And so I find when I write with machines, what I do is I give them various feelings that I want them to draw from. I give them kind of a template. So I say, I want you to, it's quite difficult to explain through through dialogue right now, but it's, I'll give them kind of like a vague template, but I'll take out all those important words that would define a poem. And instead, I give them like a large array of words that the machine can choose from. And so I'll give them different kinds of verbs, different nouns, different adjectives. And I'll arrange those so that they remain grammatically correct. And then I'll say, okay, machine, go off and pull your chaos from the universe and tell me what comes out. And then, you know, it might feel a little bit off or inauthentic. So then I'll play with the words that I've given it and I'll kind of tweak it more toward a certain feeling. And so in that way, we're really writing a poem together. We're writing many poems together, but still within my own style and voice.
Well, how do you think of your brain, Andre? Do you find that your brain is a computer, or do you feel it is a muscle with electricity pulsing through it, which then might make it a computer? I don't know. How do you construct your poems?
Well, I construct them so that an AI cannot write them. I mean, they have a different source. You know, I'm not sure that it's the same input. I think the input is another channel, and if you're, you know, in the mood or in the place, or you want to write a poem, I think you just open up the poetry faucet, also known as the Rimbaud faucet, and you just let it out. Now I'm interested in the AI. I think, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know that it can be inventive, and it can now even have a sense of humor. My son asked the AI to do a comparison or a talk about the differences and the connections between a human and an octopus. And he said the human and the octopus are living in a cave. And he asked the AI to how he made a fire in the cave underwater. And the AI said, well, you use an electric eel, of course.
That's incredible. I'm very impressed.
Do you have a sample, Chantal, of a work you made that way?
Yeah, I do somewhere. I'll dig something up. Yeah, but I think it's worth noting for everybody that AI is a very broad term. There are definitely fashions in AI. Right now we're in the art generation and the ChatGPT fashion. But if you go to something like the AI that I make, it's actually quite different from something like ChatGPT, where it's far more, how do I put this? I don't want to say.
Would you call it sculpted?
Yeah, maybe? It's far less the like me asking it to write me a poem, which you would find with ChatGPT, and it's much more me kind of, yeah, like sculpting, as you said, giving it various shapes and then letting a little, like you said, Andre, like I love the term rainbow faucet. And I don't want to bastardize that by claiming it for the machine, but maybe I'll say the chaos faucet. Part of the joy of writing poetry with machines, and I say this as a traditional poet long before I started doing this kind of poetry, I was a traditional poet myself, so I, you know, to me, nothing will ever beat the human mind. traditional. Pardon? I multitasking, not my strong suit. But yeah, there's different ways that you can interact with AI and different, like AI is really quite a meaningless term at the end of the day. When you're talking to, say, someone who builds AI or interacts with it on a more serious level. So I'm going to be quiet for a bit and find that file.
I wrote a novel, you know, in the end of the 90s called Messiah. And one of the characters is a woman from New Orleans named Felicity who interacts with a program called Make Love with People from History. And so she decides that she, on some people like Nostradamus and Mozart and Casanova, and she will have she will connect them. This is a sci-fi conceit, which has now become actual because there is an AI character in which you can really talk to people from history. So in your language, I mean, you can ask, we can talk to Hegel, for instance, but he won't speak like Hegel. He will talk like understandably in a translated language, you know. Is that right? Have you done that?
I have played with things like that, and I think they're delightful for novelty for a moment. It's impressive what people have managed to do with this kind of technology, and I admire the spirit that pushes people to chase the voices of ghosts from the past. It's a little bit like a digital seance when we do things like this. But, you know, ultimately it is inauthentic. So, like, it's more, you know, it's like an Elvis imitator after he died.
Well, there is a game on Steam, on the Steam store, called Sex with Hitler. I believe there's a Sex with Hitler 2 now as well.
Yeah.
In which gamers can finally fulfill their fantasy of engaging in intercourse with the great man. So I guess that has taken that idea to the extreme. But it's really, while Chantal is digging for a poem, no pressure on the AI. I went to this exhibition at Tate Modern this weekend last weekend with my daughter, and the artist is called Magdalena Abakanovic, and she was, I believe, she's no longer with us, an artist that weaved all these incredible tapestries and three-dimensional sculptures, at first starting with rope and tech and fabric, and then she started also weaving things with metals and other things. And the art is extraordinary because some of these tapestries are you know, many several meters high, and she actually made some works that wouldn't fit even into the turbine hall. So she was incredible. And it's funny because when you look at an artist like that with such a singular vision, you I catch myself occasionally watching videos or like photos of their ateliers and their sort of workshops. And I see that they had other people working on the stuff as well. You know, there's a video of where she's telling a couple of, weavers to work on tapestries, and she's directing them occasionally. And isn't that technically what we do with AI? It's like, are we not using these little helpers, these little workers, virtual they may be, to fulfill and realize our visions? Like sometimes we may, you know, use our computer to, you know, autocorrect our sentence. I turn that stuff off because it annoys the hell out of me. And if I'm going to put a grammatical error in my sentence, it will be there on purpose. God damn it. But it's interesting that can AI art also not just be, our helpers, our workers in the atelier that work alongside us, as opposed to something that just cheapens us and removes artistry from us?
Well, my good friend Ted Berrigan used to say that great art is a great mistake. And it's something that computers are correcting now, and that's not a good thing. When I typed, I remember making mistakes and then thinking this was a significant mistake, and I go from there, and then it became interesting. But if there is perfection involved, it's not so interesting to me. But I think artists always work with people. I mean, sculptors always hire people to do things. To build their piece. And so in a sense, you know, AI is probably going to take over, you know, just the labor of realizing a vision for an artist who needs people to finish the work.
Yes. I mean, I find it quite extraordinary, for instance, now in virtual reality, the fact that I can sculpt things out of materials that I wouldn't have been able to work with because I'm an unskilled idiot. But when I'm working with, you know, virtual sculpting tools, I can now make sculptures, form things out of nothing, and I don't need a hammer and chisel and other things in order to an expensive marble or people or an army of people to drag the materials into my house. So it's quite, I mean, AI is interesting. You know, one thing that I was thinking before we started talking is like when you move to the States, having left Romania behind for a while, the home computer was only just starting to be introduced, wasn't it, at the time?
Well, there wasn't even there. I was typing on a manual Olivetti. But then I inherited somewhere a mimeograph machine and a electric typewriter. And I've seen all these technologies from, you know, handwriting to through these things at an incredible speed evolving. And they've changed things. You know, they changed the form of poetry. We were writing then because the typewriter forced you to a sort of line break that had to do with the size of the page. So when the computers came around, you lost the end of the page. It didn't, you know, it didn't have to stop. And so, you know, these are all things and I knew the guy who was the head of the Word, the Microsoft Word group at Microsoft, and he was a very literate man, and he knew Joyce, and he put a lot of the good books in the data. In his programs, so you know it was gradual and we didn't feel it. But I think this AI is a new thing because you don't really know what it does. You know, it can surprise you. You know, and it's not all. I mean, I'm sure Chantal knows this, that it's not really all math or predictable. You know, that it will surprise us, and I'm just hoping. It can also make mistakes. And the one mistake I hope it doesn't make is that it decides that we are useless.
Is it a mistake? Dun, dun, dun. All right, sir. I completely agree with everything you guys have said. Sir. I've dug out some. I actually didn't dig them out. I went and live generated them right now for you, Andre. These are fresh, a couple of minutes old. And these are very quick ones, so don't judge all AI poetry and superior people by these, but I will read out one and then we can talk about what makes them a little bit fascinating, I think. So this is untitled because I didn't program it to give it a title. And I am colonial, skewing down the departed, backlighting, agonizing, burnable.
Yeah. That sounds like you wrote it.
It does a bit, but I did. Well, you know, we wrote it together, but I was a little bit tickled by that one because I'm like, yeah, you are burnable.
I'd love for the colonials to be burnt as much as possible.
I mean, at this point, it's most of us.
That's true.
Depends how far you want to separate descendants. Andre, you've got something on your mind.
Well, what did you tell it to say? I mean, that is the result, right?
Yes, of what you come up with. It is.
So, what was your prompt?
I will tell you. I'm going to write this in very simple terms here.
We will also post this poem, this AI poem, into the show notes for people to read and skewer their brains over. It is really, really interesting this time, because I had a conversation with Chantal the other night. We were just it's always a night somewhere. Right now it's nighttime and Chantal is, and the other night it was night where I was. Anyway, time differences and zones and all that. But we were talking about tech and how it is a part of us. I mean, it is literally something that came out of us. And therefore, is it tech or is it natural? And I'm starting to come to the conclusion that tech is natural. It is what we weave. It is the World Wide Web is our equivalent of the spider's web. It is as much a part of us as it is alien to others, and perhaps even ourselves when we take a step back. Would you agree with that, Andre?
Well, this the AI, from what I understand, follows the, or tries to the, work on not on numbers as much as on neurons, and try and imitate the human brain. And it doesn't have the same number of neurons yet, but it is a part. It is definitely a part. But then there is now, I think, some kind of moderation that goes on into AI, because without moderation, it would do what we do, which is to not always have the the best intentions, and it's can be angry and destructive because we are. So the question is, how do you moderate something that may very well very soon be out of control?
Sounds like you nailed it in your sentence. Maybe we need to be less angry and destructive. Let's just turn the tide of humanity. That will save us. No one's ever thought of it before. I've solved it, people. You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's so some listeners will have heard this before, but you know, when I met Chantal, it was actually at a video game conference in Cologne in August last year. 2022, that was, and it was this massive conference in the Köln Messe, which is the size of an airport, you know, with 265,000 people gathering there over 3 days, and video games, which have become the leading cultural form or uncultural form, depending on how you want to look at it, at them in their majority anyway. They were there and dominating all these halls with lots of noise and all that stuff. And Chantal's game was about something. And I could sense that based on just a simple GIF, just an animated little clip, basically on Twitter. And my game bizarrely was about the fear of being replaced by robots, by automation, in this increasingly technologically driven or maybe technologically dominated world. And so, yeah, I mean, these themes are very important to us as creatives. What is our place as humans in this technological world? How do we make friends with technology? How do we use it in an empathic, intentional and meaningful way, so indeed we sculpt with it instead of letting it shape our lives out of existence.
And I would add the work I do on my game, Dark Web Streamer, is very much about exploring how we can connect meaningfully and empathetically with things like AI, with technology. We've got these things like ChatGPT, and they're kind of imitating a human. But what happens when we try to allow for actual connection, when we implement them with traits that can be cared about? Now, I'm not saying I want to replace human relationships, far from it. I think my motivation is more that if we as a society are going to be spending so much time with these virtual people, our last couple of generations are absolutely growing up with spending a lot of time interacting and chatting with fictional characters via video games. What happens if we do allow them to talk back and we prompt them to ask you questions that make you reflect on your own life, your thoughts about things, on philosophy, on empathy with others?
Well, I think we're already post-human and we've been for a while because we have wires hanging everywhere from our bodies we won't have them soon. But, there's always a machine involved, and the percentage of what is human and what is machine is really hard to establish. I see in your chat here that you gave it grammatical prompts, language prompts. And it filled in the language. So you had the structural language model for it, which is interesting because that is a kind of mechanics too, because linguistics is the mechanics of language. And so you gave it that, and then it took it from there, and it did what? Use the dictionary?
So it can use the dictionary, but as I said, I prefer collaboration, so I would generally give it curated words that I have built myself. So I've made giant lists of verbs that, might have different feelings attached, evocations, and things like nouns, etc. And so I might kind of move them around or change words or add words based on the kind of feeling that I'm striving for. But we have the joy that you mentioned of the surprise. That is fundamentally what I love about, we can call it machine poetry. I might prefer to call it something like chaos poetry, is I am absolutely helping make it and sculpt it, but it's surprising me. I don't know what's going to come out. And I love when something comes out that touches me or makes me think in a way that I'd never thought before. What does it mean for the colonial to be backlighting? Why is that evocational? Why does that move me? Like, it does. It didn't mean to. The computer didn't mean to, but it did anyway. What is that?
Well, that would be you, really.
That's the beauty, right?
It is, but I think what's interesting is, like, I sort of detected that about Chantal, and I believe that my brain works the same way. I'm a similar way. Is that I'm constantly seeking new intellectual stimulation and meaning in things around me, in the world around me. And I think that's what a poet does. I mean, we are constantly, right, trying to distill meaning from things or project it on top of things, and sometimes all of the above, but always going in these sort of almost infinite loops of thought. And so sometimes we even start questioning our own thought processes, because I don't like to a place where we feel like we might even be getting sat in our own ways and our own sort of worldviews. And so the idea of actually creating an AI companion that is rich in your own poetic vocabulary and also in your own sort of intense streams and infused with all of that, and for it to surprise you back and to remind you of the fact that you can have a depth of thoughts within you that you wouldn't access consciously, and you'd need this helper, this assistant to do that for you, is interesting. I mean, it's a really cool exchange, and I've never seen anyone else use it quite that same way as Chantal. I think with her AI work, and with her game, I instantly know it's her game. Mm-hmm. Like it is her, even though there's all these non-player persons, not characters, that Chantal creates. Like I know it's her vision behind it and her voice. And I find that really, really quite stunning. It's her art. It's just her art that is alive and keeps repurposing itself into new things and surprising things. It's something new.
The Greeks, you know, had for every word there was an ancient Greek and the opposite meaning in words, and so there was a paradox, and you know, sometimes funny. So how does it, an AI would deal with humor and contradiction? You know, if you say something, but really the meaning, as you know, in language, you know, for instance, the word bad, you know, used to mean bad. And then, you know, it has changed in the subculture, you know, into good, because people say, well, that's really bad, i.e. good. So how do you deal with those kinds of ambiguities and paradoxes and humor, really?
Well, I guess linguistic paradox is in many cases separate to humor. So I have less of an answer to your question about humor. And I find that, like, to me, I would agree with you, Andre, that seems kind of like one of the biggest challenges. But in terms of linguistic paradoxes, so when we say bad, but it means good, when that's sick, but we don't mean sick, we mean like really great. That's something that I actually deal with a lot there. You know, I won't get too deep into the tech, but I will drop for our listeners. There is something called sentiment analysis, and it's lovely in some respects. I learned about sentiment analysis when I was leading something called a digital humanities project, which is using machine learning and artificial intelligence to engage with the humanities, and particularly art and literature and poetry, in ways that had never been possible before. So as an example, we might get a corpus of work from one author and then run, you know, some AI over it and find out, like, What are their favorite words? What are their favorite themes? What are things that we might pull from the text that no human has ever really been able to tag before, because it's just unrealistic that, you know, maybe someone can read the entire body of work of an author, but maybe they can't read all the works of the medieval Irish, I'm like, when the hell is medieval times? Like the 1200s? Don't ask me dates. Over these 20 years in medieval Ireland, like what kind of things were concerning them? And you can find out really interesting things by making these applications. So coming back to sentiment analysis, what that basically is the AI tagging all different words that are known to refer to a sentiment someone has about something. So, you know, in simple terms, we'll say these words mean good and these words mean bad. And so our AI, having this data, is going to now read over this body of work or these comments that have been made on an online forum, and it's going to kind of count how many positive sentiment words there are versus negative sentiment words. And if it's all positive, we know that actually they have generally good feeling about this. If it's all negative, we know, you know, negative feeling. If it's a bit mixed, we know it's a conflicted feeling, but we do.
But what if the Irish in the 12th century were all as sarcastic as they are today?
So where I was getting to was we do classify, and, you know, this is absolutely kind of a linguist problem. It's an English academics kind of purview here, is saying, okay, well, you know, here's our standard English language, but dialects and cultures, we use language very differently. So yes, we, in this particular culture or community or dialect, bad often means good. So we'll actually say in our data, we'll be like, bad actually counts as a positive sentiment, and we'll look at the surrounding context to give us more information. So if the Irish are very sarcastic, first, you cannot apply, say, one like AI bot to all different bodies of, say, literature or whatever you want to look at. They, in order to be accurate, they need to really be purpose-built for their purpose. So you can't use today's modern internet speak to analyze the Irish medieval corpus based on like straight translation. You're actually going to need linguists and historians and other relevant academics who are familiar with the dialect and the speaking culture of the medieval Irish, and they're going to make their own sentiment words. They're going to be like, okay, all these negative sarcastic words are actually good. And when they're actually really mad about something, they won't use those sarcastic words. They'll use these more formal words.
What's interesting to me is that I'm now hearing things that resemble comparative literature, except, you know, like the one person that's comparing it is an AI formed by a group of linguists and historians, etc., but through the language of code. And what's interesting is that, of course, we call it a programming language. I think it's often mistaken for tech, or very often only ever approached like tech. Yeah. But do you feel, Andre, that programming is a language?
It's a language, but it's it's a language that's evolving. But, you know, you said speaking language. Well, there's no way for us to know exactly how the Irish in the Middle Ages are speaking, because all we have is written text. And so the written text can find the patterns in the written text, because it used to be called a concordance, for instance, which was the most primitive form that people took lifetimes to find out how many times the Shakespeare used the word sword. Or certainly Shakespeare never used the word cute, but the language evolves historically. I mean, it's a historical, but it is written, you know. I mean, the Greeks said the language that people spoke, which was the demos, you know, the democratic, the language of the streets, and then there was the language that was written, which was very formal, and it was high classical expression. And that the written language, yes, you can, you know, you can. Plato transcribed the Socrates, you know, if he was a real person or Plato invented them, we don't know, but we have Plato's text, and yes, you can apply to it a pattern recognition mechanism, but you cannot do it to Socrates, who never wrote anything down. And so mostly throughout history, I think people didn't write anything down. And I think that until and in the Middle Ages, people just imitated, you know, they were religious. And so things have the meaning. The words are they were spare, as it were, just like the art, which was supposed to not deviate in any sense from, you know, for centuries from what was originally done. And innovation was considered a sin in most of Europe. So we started innovating, you know, fairly recently. This is a modern thing.
The Enlightenment.
Even writing down written thing, I mean, even writing down street language is a real recent thing. So yes, I mean, in a way, the technology evolved along with recording and hearing everything.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, I'm actually hoping that one day Jerome Lanier, who I admire greatly, of course, you know, wrote many great books about technology and our relationship to it, including You Are Not a Gadget, which is a fantastic book. And Jerome is such a fascinating character because he's such an analog person with a collection of thousands of instruments dating back to the very beginnings of musical instruments, and also believes that and Jerome has said at some point that it is actually instruments and music that invented programming, because it was the first sort of string instruments that, you know, acted very much like a binary input device. And so we have to thank, and my mother, who was a composer, and she's sadly no longer with us, but she believed that what really made her a composer is when she and made her really click with it creatively, was when she understood that music was maths. And she was not particularly good at counting and things. She actually quite rubbish at it, but she did think of, she thought about the mathematics of music when she started programming and composing her music. It's fascinating. Like, the further back we go, the more, you know, I see that our tech, our poetry is our technology. It is our most advanced technology that we have is poetry and art.
I think poetry is both now suddenly popular again, because it is a very quick way of thinking, and novels or stories are not, you know. So I'm wondering if I know the AI can tell stories, you know, because they're easier to. But nobody quite knows what poetry is, which is really its charm, you know, and its currency, you know. I mean, so what do you think about that, Chantal? I mean, do you write stories as well?
I absolutely write stories. I prefer the short story to the novel format. Yeah. What do you want to know, Andre?
Well, I want to know how you go about, using the AI to find the ending, for instance, to a story, or how you take it through a character, that begins.
Chantal will write, use the traditional brain to paper interface to write those.
I'm a traditional writer. I know you're tickled by that, Andre. You've now lived long enough to be a traditionalist.
I just noticed, I said I've lived too long, but there is no point in scaring people.
The living curse. I actually got into AI, and I got into games as a, I don't want to use the word evolution because that implies hierarchy. I was in pursuit of what I think of as first principles. So I had a curiosity about my ability to write stories. And that curiosity was, do I know story well enough that I can write fundamental story, but allow for what I call chaos, we might call randomness, to allow for things that I do not control, say topics, characters, etc. Can I write a story that understands what story is well enough to intentionally provide gaps that will be filled spontaneously while still preserving the fundamental storiness of it? So it was really a creative exercise that got me into like this whole mad life I live now. It was a challenge to myself. I felt that we've never mastered any creative form, but I felt that I was adept enough at traditional story writing that I wanted to go beyond what I had perceived anyone had ever done and challenge myself in a way that no one had ever done. And so that was where I started kind of learning AI, and I began to form this kind of modular storytelling where, like in the poems, I'm providing much of the content, much of the sculpting, but allowing for those, we call it like emergent narrative, allowing surprising narratives to emerge, and then engaging
I'm hearing almost when Chantal is talking about this, it reminds me of jazz, the idea of having music that follows a certain structure and occasionally encourages improvisation within that structure. Mm-hmm. And surprise.
Improvisation is a great word for it, actually. Like that is, and jazz is a beautiful analogy. I love jazz. I think, I adore jazz. But we talked about AI collaborators. I don't like the word assistant because I think language is important, as I'm sure Andre will agree. And the way that we use language shapes the way we think about things. I think thinking about AI as assistants in one way seems good, but in another might be too reductive. Sorry, that was a bit of a digression.
Jazz.
Thank you. You lost me. Collaborate.
No, but I was curious about Andre because you spent a lot of time in New Orleans.
My favorite place.
What is it that attracted you to that place? Was it the music? Was it the cult? What made you a New Orleans alien for a while?
Well, yes, music. New Orleans is also one of the only cities in America that has a long history, so that you. And it's filled with ghosts. And every place you go to a restaurant, history becomes restaurants in New Orleans. So every chair you sit on, somebody sat there and then died. And, you know, it feels comforting in some way.
See, you had secret best friends, Andre, because few people I know would say, this chair I'm sitting in that someone died in is so comforting.
It is.
I agree, but I love that you appreciate it too. Go on.
Is it the comfort in the style of like better them than me?
No, it's just somebody tested your food in some way. You know, it was a royal privilege to be in a place where somebody else ate. You know, first, and then I, not from the food, hopefully, but in the course of things. But music, yes. You know, I think music is pours out of everything, and I saw in New Orleans children under the freeway. Playing an instrument to just hear how the sound bounces off the cement or the environment. And, you know, people are, you know, there are people who sit to their instruments in old clubs that where the musicians go and wait for the old guys to call them on stage and make fun of them. So it's part of the culture. And it is improvised quite a bit. And that makes it an incredibly exciting place, and there are hours that only in New Orleans make sense, like 3 o'clock in the morning. Everywhere else people sleep mostly, but in New Orleans the streets are still alive. And so Chantal, you said something very interesting, which is evolution implies hierarchy, you know, and we are talking now about, you know, how you know our ways of writing and thinking are evolving along with the machinery. So I was just wondering how that works. I mean, what you meant by that.
Well, look, I'm a conflicted person because, as I've said before, if it were up to me, we would probably all go back and live in the forest and live in small village communities and have no computers and all the rest. So that might be a funny thing for someone like me to say, but so much of the reason I'm here is actually though I played video games and I grew up playing them, I was very concerned about them for a very long time. I thought that we were becoming more disconnected. We were becoming detached from nature and our natures, and I worried for the future of the world. And the reason that I was a writer and a poet, I imagine you may connect with what I'm about to say, but it wasn't the medium that I was in love with. It was the message. It was that I wanted to bring my thoughts and my ideas to people. I wanted to inspire people. And when I was very small, I loved books, and books inspired me more than anything. And so when I was young, I wanted to grow up and write books. I wanted to inspire people the way that I was inspired. But as I got older, I observed that most of the people around me were spending more and more time on things like video games and screens. And eventually I realized that the news stories and the ideas being fed to the generations that need ideas, that need vision for the future, are largely consuming them in video games. And so that's when I began to open up to exploring games as a creative medium, as a medium for fiction and writing and poetry and all the rest. Is more, I wanted to bring, ideals of empathy and meaning and connection to a generation that was, I felt it was missing out on these vital things because we had so few people actually focusing on bringing that to them in the medium. So I would not consider it an evolution.
I think it's, Andre, you've raised I think at least a couple of artificial intelligence in the form of your children in this world. And can you tell me about your son who's now doing some crazy technological stuff, which is beyond our capabilities probably. But I believe he was into Atari early on at the very beginning. Yeah. What was it like for you having come from, you know, Romania to having your first electric typewriter and then seeing your American son, Americanized son, and, you know, playing games and seeing that sort of, seeing that evolution from this and the quote unquote primitive first game to now it being, you know, tech being his language with which he also expresses himself?
Well, he drove me crazy. I didn't, you know, I thought he was wasting his time. And but he was so into his games and his computer that you couldn't get him to come to dinner. You know, he was, and then I didn't realize that actually he was working toward, you know, being an engineer, you know, and working on making microprocessors that one of them is actually driving the Ingenuity helicopter on Mars, you know.
So that's incredible.
He's done, you know, yeah, he's patented a number of things, and, you know, he had a whole different, you know, he was a different being. And then the other one actually, you know, is a psychedelic explorer who went through learned Mayan and went through the middle of Mexico on horseback and took psilocybin and ayahuasca, and is now managing a training center for psychedelic therapists in Washington State, and so in Portland. And so, you know, one of them is in outer space and one of them was in inner space. Now there's a difference of ages between them of about 5 years. The older one is the engineer and the younger one is the inner manager, explorer.
I love that.
Both of them are cosmonauts and in a way, and cosmic explorers, which I also believe your writing infuses that feeling in me when I read your poems, when I hear your poems, is that you are, and maybe this is due to you having very much, and, you know, joined America as an alien, as I did as well when I moved 3 years ago. But I feel that you're an almost sometimes an alien observing an alien, another alien civilization. Do you feel like that sometimes?
Well, yes, I did, you know, for a long time. And I still do because I'm a professional exile and I make a living. You know, I mean, if I lost my accent, I would lose a lot of jobs.
The ultimate rebel in the professional exile. I can't top that.
Yes, well,
I mean, I always say that I was born in Belgium absolutely against my own will, and I think we all have. So I think the whole idea of nationalism is so absurd because we've landed wherever we landed and entirely by accident. So anyone who wants to identify with that accident is a bit of an idiot.
Lacks imagination. But I would love to talk a little bit about Exquisite Corpse, because I think that's actually very thematic on, you know, we've talked about spontaneity and chaos and creation and collaboration and what it means to engage with art that you don't control the final output of or the final message of. So I'm familiar with Exquisite Corpse as a concept, as something of a writing exercise between multiple writers. Andre, I'm unsure, is that the idea that inspired Exquisite Corpse, and how much does that have to do with the journal that you founded?
Well, it's a good question. I think, you know, I mean, to go. I think maybe being human is the wrong career choice. You know, I mean, of course you have no say over it, but that's, you know, or where you are born, or, you know, in what time. You know, I was born in a lucky time, which was one without, you know, at least for where I lived, in, you know, a time of peace, you know, or most of humanity was living in a time of war. But Exquisite Corpse is, you know, it was a form of, you know, collaboration. And the Surrealists played the game of Exquisite Corpse, in which you write a line, leave a word, and then fold the paper and keep doing it with everyone present. So 100,000 people can play, you know, and then you just unfold it and you can have an X-ray of the human mind, of the collective mind, as it were, you know. But the magazine, when I started it, you know, I started it simply because there was a poetry establishment in this country and probably everywhere that, you know, fairly small circle that read each other and, you know, called it poetry. And we just came, you know, to kind of dismantle that formal view of poetry and allow
the
all kinds
of poets. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And we're a bit destructive and at the same time letting in people who would normally get published in the quarterlies.
Quote by, I can't remember who, by A-Punk, and it was basically, if you're ugly, you're in. And that was beautiful.
Right. Well, that's all the aesthetics, you know, are very different, and it was inspired by the Dada movement, you know, because Dadas in 1916 in Zurich, and were essentially anti-war and anti-art, and art in the sense that art was a essential support for the war machine and the you know, whatever state machine worked.
Propaganda.
You know, the Dadaists made chaos. You know,
big fan of the Dadas.
But it was, you know, yeah, it was a state of mind, really. It wasn't so much a style, because the Dadaists didn't have any style. In fact, you know, I think real artists don't have style. What they have is an impulse to make something that is startling and does something to you, whoever you are. And, you know, that was just, you know, I mean, we weren't beyond scandal or, you know, any kind of activity, you know, and certainly supported, you know, sabotage and revolution in whatever way, you know, we could. I mean, we didn't make bombs, but we made the equivalent.
You were a warrior poet. You made disruption. Agitation.
Our favorite type of person on this show, absolutely, and in life in general. It's really interesting. I for the last couple of years, I've spent my time sort of writing and directing a game where everything is scripted by me, written by me, and I've imposed and enforced dialogue on the persons, on the robots and other beings in my game, and I enjoyed that a great deal. To me, it was like doing sort of interactive theater or a piece of theater that the player can sort of engage with in virtual reality, also on a flat screen. And that was the last workers. I put my ideals in it. I put, you know, my fears in it, etc. And it was hard work. It was like 40,000 words that I had to sort of weave together for this thing and animate and listen over and over again and direct actors doing, etc., etc. And so then and then occasionally the thing that would rest my mind, I just couldn't look at long form writing during that period because there was so much writing that I had to do and constantly see. So I would, you know, quite regularly go back to your poems, Andre, and others, and poetry was a thing that would allow, like, set my mind spinning into new directions, while at the same time also, you know, respecting my time. And now I'm and then when I saw Chantal's work in the middle of making it, I was like, wow, like I was both amazed that one person didn't have to write everything in it, while at the same time thinking, oh my God, she probably has to write even more in order to create a world.
I'm an idiot.
She's a fool. And it's just, it's so interesting. I think like I feel sometimes that we are, in order to make our lives more interesting and more stimulating, we want to, we're profoundly lazy human beings in some ways, but we're also, by being lazy, by wanting to be stimulated, we actually make everything so much harder on ourselves. How good are you at leisure, Andre? Like, a lot of people turn their brains off playing video games, and that is something that I think Chantal and I are trying to work against, or we're trying to at least infuse life with feeling and meaning and intent when you spend so much time in games. How do you switch off, or how do you switch on outside of your own work?
I think you are both very nice people. I mean, I don't never switch off. I don't know how you do that. I can see any, you know, if I don't do, if I, my only job is to think, and if I don't do that, then I feel lazy, or maybe I'm sick. You know, I don't.
Oh, that's true. I never switch off either.
Relatable. Yeah, I'm like, of all the people that talk about switching off, like, need to leave this room.
I have
no. We can't switch off.
But you are, Chantal, especially. You know, I mean, how do you think your generation is nicer? I mean, you are nicer people. And you proceed from a very positive view of the world.
I describe Chantal as many things, but not nice.
Yes, you don't know the real me. No, like, this is not an ego stroke, but I do tend to be a natural idealist and optimist in some ways, while horribly depressed about the future. I cling desperately to my optimism, my poorly placed optimism. I do think with the newer generation that, you know, I don't want to say older generations, but, you know, the generation that came before, we iterate in everything we do. You know, we talk about instruments as the original, like, programmatic machines. We talk about poetry as this kind of like ultimate technology, which is a comment we pass by, but I think is worth engaging with more, because I agree. But, you know, we iterate on everything we do. The technology shifts every generation, but something we also iterate on is culture, and obviously language. It is the poet's job to iterate on language very literally. Poetry, you know, you mentioned you can't really define poetry, Andre, but for me at least, poetry is the attempt to express the formerly inexpressible, these intangible experiences of humanity that we know or we suspect that others have, but we don't have the language to ask. You know, like, do you feel this way?
Yeah. Well, no, that's absolutely, you know, sure. I grew up in a communist country with compulsory optimism. I mean, we were supposed to be both happy, and we are not, and work toward the great future of humanity, which was an idea that nobody really believed. And so, on the one hand, we had this official language, you know, that you didn't speak with, you know, the top of your voice, but things that really you felt or concerned, you poets are the only ones allowed to do that. And everybody else just lied, you know. So language, in fact, you know, there was a big lie. Every time somebody opened their mouth, they lied. And they lied so they wouldn't be overheard by the authorities, who are compulsively optimistic. And so the only other attitude toward that was to not be pessimistic, but to question everything, to be, you know, to have a kind of cynicism about the official language. And so that was part of the, you know, that was because we didn't have any opposition politics. And so the only way you could even express an opposition was through poetry. And, you know, the authorities became very good at reading your poetry. Great readers in censors would Amazing. Find you. Some image about, you know, a red bird, you know, and they say, what do you mean by that? I mean anything, you know, just
I had an interesting conversation with Andrzej Wajda about that, the great Polish filmmaker, and when he made this film, his film Canal, and very much in the depths of censorship in Poland. The ending of the film, I don't want to spoil too much, but it is a purely visually told ending. And you look across the Vistula River and the camera is sort of just very slowly zooming in on to the other side of it from behind a caged window. And everyone in the audience knew that at the end of this film, what Wajda was saying was that on the other side of that river, the Russians are going to come next. So whatever horrors you're stuck in now, they're not over. It's going to get possibly even worse, which it did. But if he had put this in the script, it would have been censored because, you know, the Soviets were in charge. But it was entirely visually told. And I'm just having this thought now because I'm thinking about the big tech giants who use very similar language to the sort of Soviet overlords and these big community builders. These aren't we all a big happy clappy place where we're all joined together in the great Google experiment or whatever? And do you feel that history has gone strangely circular where these capitalists, these tech capitalists are running us in a similar way and their idealism is similar to that of the communist leaders back then. And that for a while we were speaking a visual language through Instagram and other places that could have avoided the censors. But now even the images get understood by AI. Even the images now get analyzed and we understand and AI can analyze the content of what we're saying visually. Are we more prone to censorship now than we ever were beforehand?
Yeah, I think we're living a softer dictatorship and because it doesn't hurt so much. I mean, it hurts if you are interrogated in person. It doesn't to have your phone know where you are at all times. And you really don't have any secrets because it is all, you know, recorded. It's almost, you know, the metaphysics of the 19th century were really the technology of today in the sense that people connected with entities from the other world and they said this and they said that, but they believed in the Akashic record, which was, you know, the record of everything.
You dirt.
So now it's here. So, you know, is there any way of avoiding it? I don't think so. But, you know, what the result is in a sort of that you must defend whatever it is, like you're saying, unsayable or unspeakable and maybe ambiguous, maybe poetically, maybe only poetry and images can do that. You know, and machines can't. And finding out what machines can't do is both the reason to use them and to defeat them. I mean, I don't, you know. So yeah, I think the answer is yes. We live in an extraordinary surveillance, surveilled world. not surveilled by people. It's surveilled by AIs, by machines.
Absolutely. We're living in the panopticon. That nightmare future that was envisioned has absolutely come true. We always feel that we are being watched, because we are, in a way. It's pervasive. Everything we do online is tracked in ways that we can't begin to fathom. Technology has gotten so good that it can guess what we're thinking based on what we look at. It can guess what we want to be looking at, even when we're not. And then you leave your house and your smartphone is tracking you, your smartwatch is tracking you, the cameras all over the street. We've got people with Ring doorbells now. You know, you've got the police when they're doing an investigation, they're knocking on doors and trying to find who has Ring doorbells to kind of like track people as they go. Everywhere we go is known.
The global village, you know, is really more like an 18th century peasant village, because it's smaller. The world has become smaller. And the thing about the village of the 18th century is that everybody knew everybody's business, and because you could see them and you knew them. And in a sense, what has gotten smaller, you know, is and like a village, this global village, is the fact that we now know what everybody is doing, and some people know more.
But funny enough, I feel the thing that is so strange in this village that we now inhabit is that, unlike the villages back in the day, when if there was this one rich man who terrorized everyone, owned everything, surveilled everyone, pretended to give them what they want, when in fact just enriching himself, everyone knew who that person was. I mean, within and where they lived, they would eventually pick up their shovels and axes and they would break into that house and get rid of them, because, you know, after a while it gets a bit boring. But now we live in a world where our GPS overlords are literally telling us what our next step is going to be at all points. But we don't even have the basic curiosity to use the tools that they've given us, so to speak, the Googles, etc., to Google them.
Yes, but yeah, they've iterated. The ones who would be murdered by the axes and the whatever have iterated on their defenses, and they figured out how to kind of add those extra layers of security between the village and murder.
While at the same time also turning us all into these sort of surveillance, like these Spitzel, as they were called in East Germany, people who sort of inform and sort of look at the neighbors that look out the windows, like, oh, is he doing what he should be doing as a sort of obedient citizen? But we don't even Google the people that are ruling us. We have lost. Yeah, you do. I know, but we are curious individuals. But it's so funny. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I can ask like random people in the street if they know where. We won't speak his name, but the guy who has the electric car company.
We have a ban on that, Twitter, that guy's name.
Yeah, we have a ban on it. We're not allowed to mention his name on the show. And they have no idea where he's from. They don't know that he comes from an emerald mining empire, you know, from a profoundly, like, you know, colonialist.
Oh, no. Potentially. He was homeless. He had to sleep in his tiny little office to get this dream off the ground. What a hero.
That's
we
true.
Can all sleep yes. in our office and get rich if we dream hard enough.
I mean, when he founded PayPal, he had to share a room at a university with a white supremacist. It must have been very, very difficult.
Oh, yes, for that South African white man from a mine.
It's the tech Middle Ages, you know.
eBay, I meant. Was it eBay, PayPal? I don't know. New he didn't found it. Stories, I think he bought it.
Go on, Andre, sorry.
No, sorry. It's a new origin stories, you know, that people make for themselves in this sort of new tech Middle Ages. You
Aren't
know?
They great fiction writers?
That's what I'm thinking, that you know, so popular, are so popular games that have the motifs of the Middle Ages and the action of the Middle Ages, because we do live in a time where, you know, there's a lot of clanking and of armor and clashing of swords, and, you know, that sort of imagery has kind of risen in the you know, games, and people are so preoccupied with it because they probably feel unconsciously that we are, you know, there is a battle between in the night between great powers and, you know.
Yeah, and we don't have that natural biological human outlet anymore, or at least, you know, the peasants don't. The wealthy have their pretty little drones. But yeah, actually, I didn't quite finish what you asked me a question, Andre, and that was about optimism in the new generation. And I started to talk about iteration. And where I was going with that is that every generation iterates on the culture and beliefs and attitudes of those who came before us. And so one of the ways that the modern generation has iterated is that we have made greater space for permission to talk about our feelings. And in some ways, we do have greater permissibility to voice our concerns and be very honest about them and commiserate with people who agree with us about them, which is obviously something you were not fortunate to experience growing up. But people like you took those experiences of not being able to speak your mind or feel your feelings. And I think a great many people from these backgrounds, these, you know, micro generations, they had children and they raised their children, and those memories never left, the memories of the trauma and what it was like to not be able to speak up. And so you taught your children different values, and you placed a greater emphasis on not stifling the way that you had been stifled. And, you know, that's very general. There are people with trauma who replay that trauma with their children, who, you know, do what's been done to them. But I would say we, as all generations do, have the benefit of our parents' wisdom and that wiggle room. So we have a language available to us that allows for this perhaps perceived greater optimism, even in the face of the apocalypse.
We didn't pay enough attention to traumas in the 1960s, where we tried to make a utopian world. We dropped out, and then we did all sorts of things that, but we didn't deal with the traumas, actually, of our parents. We separated completely, and so we cut the possible wisdom that we may have, you know, had if we had thought more about it instead of trying to make a totally separate world. And so that utopia failed because, you know, for the old, for the lack of old wisdom about relationships, about feelings, about, you know, jealousy, competition, all of that perfectly human stuff.
Yeah, they were like infected wounds. You just let them fester. And now the job of the coming generations is to find the salve so we can actually heal them. You need to get rid of the infection and then we can heal.
Well, thank you, doctor. That's good.
You're welcome. Let me just dig around in my backyard. Whip that right up for you.
Shall we? I think we should heal, and I think we need to both, you know, explore and dive into our traumas, and that's also part of the reason why I'm sure Chantal and I have separately been working on our own horror stories, because there is a very empathetic thing about doing, like allowing, like facing people with fears, with real fears, with real trauma, because out of that comes hope, as opposed to just presenting them with usually white caped crusaders who come out of the sky and sort of ensure that the status quo gets, you know, fought for. And so I am actually full of hope that at the very least in our separate corners here of, you know, we can get our, you know, sharpen our poetic swords and fight for humanity and empathy and positivity and beauty. And Andrea, you have done that your entire life, and I would like to thank you for coming on the show, because it's, you know, we could talk for hours.
Well, thank you both for making a hopeful day, because my day is just starting here, so it's better because we've had this conversation.
It was really nice talking to you. It's tragic when we have to leave.
Well, Andre, maybe you should come back.
Okay,
we'll come back. Let's fight a few beautiful fights in our various corners of the planet, and then regroup next year after we've made everything better.
Okay,
why don't we do that?
All right. So we should also use all these new AIs to help, because they could be. They're still malleable, I think.
Absolutely.
Oh, we will.
It could be turned into a kind of jujitsu against technology.
See you all on the next Directional.
Directional is hosted by Jörg Tittle in London, Chantal Ryan in Adelaide, and produced by Paul Bennin in Los Angeles for Rapid Eye Movers. The theme song was composed by Oliver Krauss and Frally Hines. Follow us on Twitter @directionalshow and listen to past episodes at directional.show. See you next time.